Thank you very much, Leslie. I want to echo what Leslie says. I think we're all going to feel pretty good about our field at the end of today. And I think that's the right kind of frame of mind to be in terms of talking about its future. So I'm going to go ahead and get started with my presentation. You'll have to bear with us. Each of these is going to be recorded separately. So you're going to hear the acknowledgement statement. Probably by the time Mark presents, we can all sing it together. So I'd like to acknowledge the funding for this summit from the National Institute on Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research, and also from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. And I'd also like to thank the UIC College of Medicine's Department of Psychiatry for its generous support. And finally, I'd like to inform you that I have no conflicts of interest to report in regard to this presentation or any of today's activities. And I'm going to start my presentation talking about the early years because I think the early years reflect where we've come in terms of what we even consider to be psychiatric rehabilitation research. We were at thresholds in 1990 when we won our first grant, a large psychosocial rehabilitation agency in Chicago, and our research topics and translation efforts, I think, reflected the pre-recovery era. We did a study of NAMI family support groups, and the people in those support groups, if you will recall back then, were primarily parents and siblings. People with lived experience didn't come to those support groups, may not have even felt welcome in some cases. We did a survey of employers of workers with mental illness. We wanted to know, who are these people? And are they different from their colleagues that don't hire people with mental illness? So each employer chose a colleague like them in gender and race, education, but that didn't hire people with mental illness. We did a 1-year follow-up of people with mental illness after closure from VR, the famous Status 26. We wanted to know how many are still working. And we found that a large percentage were, more than half, and an even higher percentage of those who were working, close to 60%, were working at the same job that they had held when they left VR clienthood. And we looked at the predictive validity of a vocational assessment battery that was very popular back then, but that had people do hammering and screwing and a lot of manly type things. And first of all, we wanted to know, does this predict any better than a situational assessment, taking people out to actual work sites and letting them work and observing? And if it does, fine. It didn't quite do as good a job, but is it really fair to women? You know, I still have trouble with screwdrivers and wrenches and things like that. And we found in our research that women got poorer scores on, it's called the McCarran Dial, but they didn't have poorer vocational outcomes. So that was the research. We did a manual, it's so quaint, on how psychosocial rehabilitation programs could reach out to local researchers. Look in the phone book. Identify your community colleges. Call the head of psychiatry or social work. Explain what your program does and say that you're open to master's students coming. We took what we'd learned about assessing vocational performance and created a manual of clinical and rehabilitation assessments with Sam. That's correct. We're going to get shout-outs to everybody in the audience who worked with us. And this was so early in the game that having an annotated bibliography of psychosocial research was considered a big deal. So the research field was so nascent, so in its very beginning, that was exciting. In 1995, we moved to UIC's Department of Psychiatry. It was a very different home for us. And we did some different research. We wanted to know whether women in psychiatric rehabilitation programs did as well as men. So we carried our interest in gender over. So we conducted a national women's needs assessment. We looked now at positive parent-adult-child relationships and looked at the idea that older parents of an adult with mental illness actually got a lot back from that person in the way of caregiving and socialization and so forth. We did that work with Sue Pickett, who will be here later. We did our first study of consumer service delivery on a mobile outreach team. at Thresholds and looked at how did they deliver services? Was it different from the non-consumer staff? And what were the clients' outcomes? Were they any different? And we did new statistical approaches to vocational rehabilitation research. And you want to know what they were? Things like, we'll laugh now. I mean, a master's level student would apply logistic regression in an analysis. But I know I published the first logistic regression of supported employment. We applied canonical correlation in looking at whether vocational and residential outcomes were similar, had similar predictors. We explored regression discontinuity. These things are all old now, but it was interesting that that was one of our calling cards, was our statistical knowledge. Our manuals got more sophisticated. We created a manual to run a support group for trauma survivors called Hope for Healing. We created the first manual for hiring peers, again, called Consumers, into your community mental health program, and how to really look at your program from its mission statement all the way down to its personnel policies and making peer service deliverers feel welcome and having them be effective. Probably to follow that, we worked with Sam Shore and Lori Curtis, who many of you know, to create a book called Managing Workplace Conflict. Because we wanted peers to have the skills to be able to do that if they weren't treated or hired by people who had read our Positive Partnerships Manual. And this really speaks to the idea that it was pre-RRTC for transition age youth time, we did a transition age youth employment series where we did a manual on natural supports, a manual for parents on how to encourage your young adults' vocational aspirations. One of the big pieces of advice is, you know, don't keep nagging them to get a job. You know, that's where we were back then. So fascinating. And then in 2000, technology use was growing and self-determination was entering the field from the larger disability movement. We were shocked to see self-determination in our priorities. We kind of knew what it meant, but it wasn't being used in mental health. Its foundation was there, but basically making the statement that people who receive services have the right to self-determination was not a commonly accepted belief in our field. We did a national web survey on internet use among people with mental illness. Did they have equal access? Were they in the bad side of the digital divide? We did a cultural competency training program for NAMI support groups. Does anyone remember back then there was a movement to create ethnically specific NAMI support groups because people that were non-white didn't feel welcome in the groups that they were attending. Do you remember that? And we just wanted to develop something for the groups to outreach and be more culturally competent. So each NAMI sent its head and then a person of color that belonged to it. And oh, it was a wild project. It was lots of fun. We also looked at outcomes of mothers with mental illness who were receiving services in programs that serve both the mother and the preschool child. We did a case file abstraction methodology there. Because self-determination was so new, there was a hue and cry to not just borrow the one that developmental disability had and the one that physical disability had, but to make one special to psychiatric disability. So we brought together consumer leaders like Joseph Rogers, Larry Belcher, Judy Chamberlain, Ray Guevara, David Oakes, Andrea Schmuck, Suzanne Vogel-Scabelia. Do you remember some of these names? Some people have passed on by now. We also invited people from the physical and developmental disability communities, Laurie Powers and Tamar Heller, and others that that were conceptualizers from psychosocial rehabilitation, Kathy Furlong Norman and Barbara Granger. And we created a framework for self-determination for people with mental health conditions. We didn't quite use that word. And it wasn't that different, but it really gave the field some ownership. We created a bibliography of resources on self-determination for people with mental illness, and we created the self-determination tool series that I'll talk about more in a moment. We also created a peer outcomes protocol. That was also mandated that we do it. We worked with Jean Campbell from the University of Missouri. There weren't that many peer-run programs that we could find that were going to use it, but we developed it and it assessed areas that were important, like self-esteem and work and residential and the atmosphere of your peer-run program. And I will tell you that sat really basically unused for almost a decade. And now managed care companies want it. And states want to introduce it statewide to the peer programs that they fund. Little something about translation there that I'll double back to in a minute. We developed an advanced crisis manual and video training for seclusion and restraint based on our research on seclusion and restraint, and a support group manual for people with HIV and mental illness. I know I've left out some projects, but I think you can see just in that 15 years how the field changed, and we're really only up to 2005. So what I want to do is fast forward to more recent history, where under the umbrella of the Center on Mental Health Services Research and Policy, we've had our current center, the Center on Psychiatric Disability and Co-occurring Medical Conditions before that, and the National Research and Training Center on Psychiatric Disability before that. And I want to focus on those because that's where the translation and the science came from. At the time of our current center in 2015, we took a look at what the needs were, what was the state of the science at that, and really the state of the field at that time. And what we saw is something that's still the case, which is that the mental health workforce doesn't have ready access to evidence-based practices and to promising practices. Or if they have it, they don't have it in a way that can be translated directly into practice. Right? There was low awareness that self-direction, increasing choice, and peer support can activate people to enter treatment, to engage in treatment, and to stay in treatment. All right? We don't tend to necessarily think about those as treatment facilitators. But because there's a focus on treatment right now, that was something that we felt was true. There were a lack of models integrating primary care with behavioral health care, and the models that did exist hadn't really been researched. They sounded great, and Medicaid was funding them, but we didn't know if they worked for outcomes in each area and if they worked for people with psychiatric disabilities. If the providers couldn't get to the evidence-based practice, you could be sure the policymakers were running into obstacles if they wanted to do system change around the area of evidence-based practices. So we knew we had to find another way of approaching policymakers. And then finally, we knew the next generation of researchers, scientists, needed to know how to study all of these questions. And some of them are particularly challenging. So I want to say a little bit about the recent science, and I'm really just going to talk about that briefly. I'm going to talk about its translation later on in my presentation. So we worked with the Copeland Center and the state of Ohio to do a randomized control trial of Wellness Recovery Action Plan, RAP. It was everywhere. It's a great example of a practice that was international before there had been any research on it. It's really interesting. And we showed that RAP improves symptoms, particularly depression and anxiety, hopefulness, self-advocacy with medical providers, and quality of life. We studied bridges with Sue Pickett, NAMI Tennessee, and the Tennessee Mental Health Consumers Association. Bridges stands for Building Recovery of Individual Dreams and Goals Through Education and Support. It's a mostly peer-led intervention, and we found that it improved empowerment, assertiveness, hopefulness, and a sense of recovery from mental illness in two interesting dimensions. One is the ability to go forward with your life and feel you're okay with residual symptoms, which I know is a major challenge for some people. And secondly, an improvement in your ability to feel that the plans you make are realizable. All right. We did our first randomized control trial of self-directed care. We worked with the state of Texas, Sam Shore again, the North Texas Behavioral Health Authority, the managed care organization Value Options, and published the first study to show that people that received self-directed care, had improved symptoms, self-esteem, coping mastery, increased employment, and greater satisfaction with services, all for no greater money spent on them compared to the control group, and in some service areas, significantly less. We followed up on SAMHSA's Employment Intervention Demonstration Program, its multi-site study of evidence-based supported employment. Richard Goldberg was in that project. Lisa Dixon, who's here, was in that project. And what we wanted to know is, what happened to those people? What happened a decade later after they stopped getting supported employment? And we work with the Social Security Administration to track their records and see, because we knew they were going to still probably be involved with Social Security. And we found that 10 years later, over 10 years later, people that got supported employment were more likely to work, had higher earnings, and were more likely to have had their cash benefits reduced due to work by SSA. We did a series of community health fairs in which we screened people for common comorbidities that occur with serious mental illness. We partnered with CSPNJ and Peggy Swerbrick and her staff. She really came up with this idea. And we used it to gather epidemiological data and also to see if health fairs could actually serve as sources of empowerment in addition to education. We also identified a lot of undiagnosed diabetes, high blood pressure, and hypoglycemia. And we found that after a one-hour health fair, people showed, this was just a pre-post, not a randomized control trial, greater competence in health management, greater self-perceived ability to engage in health practices, things like, I listen to my body and watch for changes and then tell my doctor about that. That was news to some people, that you could do that. And then also something called health locus of control. So that's the science. We're done with that. I want to mention, we pulled off some other great projects. Lynn Mock is here today, and Jane Burke. We assessed all of the women on TANF who were within 2 years of having their eligibility terminated. So this was after welfare reform. And we found very high rates of mental illness and substance abuse disorders. There's other research projects that I could tell you about, but they don't illustrate my translation points, so I'm skipping a lot. Sometimes knowledge translation occurs over time, and it can go from the intervention existing and then being researched to the research being done and then the intervention being promulgated. And one that I think is really interesting is NUAR, Nutrition and Exercise for Wellness and Recovery. This was developed by Dr. Katana Brown at Midwestern University. It was a 6-month program. It was shown to be an evidence-based practice, but we knew no mental health center in today's public system was going to deliver a 6-month program. They're just not set up for that. So we asked Tana if she would please design something for 2 months. She's an occupational therapist. She was kind of like, I don't know about that. But she worked with a bunch of people in recovery to come up with a class that lasts for 2 months and covers a lot of things. Then they decided we need exercise videos for this because we really would like people to engage in some more physical activity so they can see its effect on its mood while they're still together, not just healthy eating. So they developed videos. Jane Fonda did not star in our videos. But there was a reason for that. We wanted people in recovery to be doing these exercises. We wanted at least one of them to be seated when they were doing these exercises because we wanted to promote the idea that you don't have to stand in order to do these exercises. And OT graduate students worked together to do a series of videos, but fun things, like there's a video of exercise for dancing, kickboxing, yoga, core work. So things that people would be interested in doing. We made all of those available to the field, and they became very popular. And then came the science. And luckily, we were around as a rehabilitation research and training center, still working together and with Tana to be able to get money to do a pre-post evaluation that was external to our RRTC, but during the time of our most current RRTC. And then we were lucky to get a Nidler for field-initiated research grant in order to do the RCT on NEWER, all these acronyms, to see whether it's an evidence-based practice. It was adopted by the SAMHSA, HRSA, PBHCI grantees, the Primary and Behavioral Healthcare Integration Project that SAMHSA did for 8 years. What was good about that? There were 213 sites funded under that program. And SAMHSA was very interested in having those sites that were integrating health and behavioral health know about NEWER, use it. They even included it in their grant announcements. So that was a huge boost. The state of Illinois, and Darius is here, he was spearheaded that effort, adopted it statewide. They started adopting it in IPS programs, but then they said, heck, this is, why are we limiting this to people that want to work? Let's get people trained up in every region of the state. Let's start pressuring, I'm sure they don't use that word, community mental health providers to use it. And let's set up a system to track it, because we all know that if it doesn't get tracked, what happens? It doesn't happen. So that was exciting. And now we have NEWER featured in the solution suite, which I'll tell you a little bit more in a moment. Translation can also occur not just across RTCs, but across multiple RRTCs. And a good example of that is our self-determination tools. I mentioned these before. We developed them back in the 2000 RRTC. And in addition to developing them, we disseminated them to the field. It was our first package of tools. There was a person-centered planning guide. There was a self-assessment of self-determination in your life, things like who you live with, whether you have a roommate, whether you can engage as a citizen in political action, whether you have choice over health and mental health, where you live, do you have public transportation? All of those areas people were able to assess their self-determination in. We also had a raising difficult issues tool that we developed. How do you tell your case manager, it really makes me feel bad when you're constantly a half hour late for our meetings, and it starts our meeting together, I start off with a bad feeling. Is there something we could do about that? It's very hard to bring up these kind of issues. Or you talk too much about work and I'm not ready. Or the opposite, you never talk about work and when I bring it up, you discourage me. So that was a good tool. And then seeking supported employment was a tool that we developed. Then for the next center, we didn't use them that much. We were off to co-occurring medical conditions, but we did test our self-directed care model and adapted it for people with mental illness, and we were able to use the person-centered planning guide in that intervention. And that's mandated, as you may know, by Medicaid, that if you're doing self-directed care, there has to be a person-centered plan. And now we have these tools available in the solution suite, which is the second time you've heard about this, and I haven't really defined it yet. I think the point of my presentation is that psychiatric rehabilitation is local, it's regional, it's international, it's about scale, right? If we really want to translate, right? It's not just a few programs adopted what we're doing, but a whole state is using it or a whole country is using it. And also, translation occurs across age groups. And I just want to take a moment to talk about our RAP for Seniors program. So RAP was evaluated, I told you this already, in one of our centers, can't remember which one, and found to be an evidence-based practice, which was great. And then we were approached by Administration on Aging of HHS, which is next to the Administration on Community Living, which, as you know, is the home of NIDLR. And they said, we love this. This was refreshing. We think this could be an evidence-based practice for seniors. Would you please nominate it for our Chronic Disease Self-Management Education Program, CDSME? And our first reaction was, what? You have a Chronic Disease Self-Management Education Program? And they said, oh, yeah, we've had that program for a while. And actually, states have to set aside a certain portion of their federal funds in order to pay for Chronic Disease Self-Management Education Programs. And we were, wow, that's great. So we nominated it, it got accepted as an evidence-based practice, and it's now being brought to scale in the state of Illinois. It's the same old rap, adjusted a little bit for an older population, but using all the same materials and tools. Never in a million years would I have thought we would be doing a project in the aging field. It's very, very different. Okay, and so that's one form of translation that I wanted to mention. And then another form of translation is international. And we know that Marianne knows quite a bit about that, but it's a little newer to us. We, you know, studied bridges. It was an evidence-based practice. And some global mental health researchers came to us and said, we're developing a stepped care depression treatment model for women in Tajikistan. And we were like, what? You want to use bridges there? And they said, yeah, and they have a really bad situation. It's a totally patriarchal culture. They go from their father's house to their husband's house, and they're under the control of their mothers-in-laws who beat them. That's considered normative. And what happened? Of course, the women loved it. It was the first time anyone had told them that they could be empowered. They loved the part that educates you on how to talk to your psychiatrist. They just used it for their mothers-in-laws. I didn't use my head when I thought about the fact that something like this could be powerful in another country. We tested it on an R21 in Dushanbe, which is the capital of Tajikistan, and then the researcher got an R01, and now it's going to be in every primary care clinic in the country, which is a small country, but still not in a million years. One of my favorite parts of adapting bridges was, you know, it uses, you know, sayings that are cultural, like, give me one that bridges might have. There's always a rainbow behind every dark cloud. And they had to be translated. That meant nothing to Tajik women. And so that got translated as, the goat cries, his tears fall in his milk. We are sad. I didn't see the empowerment part of that, but this was their, you know, curriculum. We went with it. They loved it. Another form of translation that I don't think we pay enough attention to is translating evidence-based practices from other fields of medicine into behavioral health. And we learned a lot about this when we developed our diabetes education toolkit with our RTC funding for our most recent center. We did it to address the critical need among people with mental illness who have a much higher rate of diabetes for educational materials they could understand, and not just them, their case managers and the people that were working with them. So we created this toolkit. We used it in an evaluation of an integrated behavioral health care clinics, two clinics actually, and now it's been recognized by AHQR, the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research, as a quality tool. We thought all our tools were quality tools, but that was their designation, and it's featured in their Healthcare Innovations Exchange. It was also heavily marketed to the PBHCI sites, so a lot of people got to see it that way. Just want to briefly mention that translation also needs to take into account the different provider groups involved, and we also learned this with Neuer. With PRA, they mainly got together with their annual conference. There were some statewide conferences. If you wanted to impact psychiatric rehabilitation providers, CPRPs, you needed to be at those conferences. And you needed to publish in Psychiatric Rehabilitation Journal, which shout out to, where's Kim? Is he here? Which Kim and I edited, and we're very glad we're no longer editing it, although we really enjoyed it. But that was the way to reach CPRPs. In a different way, we reached the SAMHSA, HRSA grantees. I've spoken about that. And then in an even different way, we reached Illinois. Illinois had peer providers. It had psychosocial rehabilitation providers. It had managed care companies. They all needed to be convinced and educated about Neuer. And translation involves branding through compelling and unique product and packaging design. See how unfamiliar those words are to me? I actually had to read them. Luckily, I had other people that we worked with, like Peggy Swarbrick and Pat Nemec, who helped us put together our solution suite. We borrowed shamelessly from Microsoft Office Suite, All right, but if you think about it, Microsoft Office Suite has a word processing program, a spreadsheet program, a database program. You can design through Microsoft, whatever it's called that I don't know how to use, Publisher. And it's marketed together, and it's a comprehensive package. And so we said to ourselves, let's do that. I mean, you know, after six centers, we were tired of every other thing we tried. So we put together the solution suite and worked with the people at CSPNJ. Here's what we feel, if you want to put something like this together, is effective as a translation, set of translation strategies. First of all, it has to be available for free. It's not going to be adopted if it costs virtually anything. It needs to be deliverable at minimal cost. Everything costs something to deliver, but it can't cost a lot. It needs to be rehabilitation and recovery oriented. That's just because we believe it. I can't give you any other rationale than that's what we wanted to do. I think we also believe that this leads to a lot of other positive outcomes. It needs to require low to moderate intensity training. Agencies are not going to give their staffs a lot of sophisticated training that's expensive. So therefore, that training needed to occur through the suite. We use podcasts and archived webinars, how-to webinars, on how to use the product, how to deliver it to other people. It needed to complement traditional behavioral health treatment. We're not putting something in there, although we have no problem with it as an intervention, that is all about stopping taking your meds, for example. For this solution suite, we wanted it to complement meds, case management, meeting with your psychiatrist. We wanted it to be supported by research and evaluation. Some of the things in the solution suite are evidence-based practices. We wanted it to respond to outcomes that people in recovery care about, not just the ones that the state is paying for or Medicaid pays for. And it needed to be supported by free technical assistance, which made us a little scared because we were afraid that we would be inundated. So in the suite are 10 products that integrate behavioral health and primary care. You've heard about NuAR. You've heard about the online diabetes tool. There's a wellness activities manual to introduce people to all kinds of different wellness activities like yoga and journaling, so forth and so on. We developed physical wellness for work, really with some SAMHSA funding through the IPS initiative. That's very popular. We took a tool that we used in our health fair research, the health passport, and created a portable health record for people to be able to carry that included a series of tests, what they meant, and an opportunity for you to be able to record your tests and just have something in a user-friendly booklet. And we also studied WHAM, Whole Health Action Management, Larry Frick's intervention, if you're familiar with that. We did an RCT on it. We've just finished it. It's not published, so I didn't put it in our science column, but we found that it had significantly better outcomes than controls for health activation that I talked about earlier. For employment, which is totally unexpected, but will definitely make it easier to sell and kind of gets back to this link between employment and health and a couple other areas I can't remember because I'm trying to focus on translation. 8 products promote self-direction and behavioral health treatment. We finally are using the self-determination tools during a period of time when the rest of the field is kind of caught up to us. And luckily, they came out of a self-determination framework that was relevant for the people that we care about. And a number of other tools. I just encourage you to go and take a look at the suite. Each, and this is part of the packaging, so I'll just alert you to that. Each of the products has a similar landing page because people like similar introductions. Before, you had to go all over our various websites to find something, and there it sat, and you had to call us and say, is this appropriate to use with, you know, this kind of person, and would you send it to me? Now you can download it immediately by clicking on it. There's a description of what the program is, who it's designed for, how it works, the mechanisms of change, the active ingredients that it uses, what resources are required so you know up front whether your agency or program can afford to deliver it, and what experience is required in order to teach it. If you click on the red microphone button, you hear the podcast. If you click to the right of that on the slides, you hear the training webinar. And at the bottom is the dreaded red box that you click for technical assistance, which, believe it or not, very few people click. So our concerns about that breaking the bank were unfounded. A word about branding. We developed a logo for the solution suite. We hope you like it. There are different colors for the three areas. Green, which for employment, the color of money, and for financial education and all those green things. That may be a little culturally bound. Money may not be green in other cultures, so sorry about that. Blue for health and yellow for self-determination and empowerment. These are things that if we keep putting this in front of people, we hope they'll say, that's a solution suite thing. I've seen that logo before. All right, so that's part of the branding that I was talking about. We're almost done. I wanted to introduce you to the rest of our center's translation program, because what I mainly talked about is translation to service providers. But we also were very bound and determined to translate to policymakers and to scientists. And so I mentioned Peggy Swarbrick. Sam Schur is the director of our Academy for Policymakers. He's here with us today, along with Kelsey, whose last name I still can't pronounce, but has helped us make a series of interesting tools that I'll talk about in a moment. And then Jane Burke Miller, who with Lisa Rosano directs the Science Showcase. So just briefly, the Academy for Policymakers is what do policymakers pay attention to? Infographics. We wanted policymakers to know there were peer services all around the country, maybe even in your own state that you're not even aware of. So we created an interactive map that you can click on your state. You can see how many peers have been trained as of 2016 anyway, whether the state has a training and certification program, and the website for that training and certification program. I have used this so many times when people have come up to me and said, those peer services, are they in my state, my area? Lacey used it when she put her grant together. It's just been a wonderful resource. We're waiting for someone else to come along and gather some recent data, which we'll then use and put in it. But infographics on ISMIC, it's an important policy committee that's been established by SAMHSA, but it can be hard to find information about it. It's really going to chart the future of SAMHSA, as Marianne Davis well knows, because she sits on the ISMIC committee. So we wanted to introduce the field easily to what it was supposed to do, and what its initial recommendations, the committee's initial recommendations were. The Science Showcase, designed for scientists, for students, contains podcasts and webinars on different research topics, our own research. The major tool we created for the Science Showcase was a tool for people that wanted to use large data sets, because we'd like to encourage more people to use large data sets, because everything I hear is, we need to see that in a representative sample, or we need to see data that's national. And so those are the big gun surveys that when I was a young Sprout researcher, I had no idea whether there was information about mental illness in them, how mental illness was assessed in them, how they had been used to do mental health research. So the large data set compendium introduces you to all of that, tells you exactly what kind of mental health data is included and how mental health is assessed, whether it's diagnosis or symptoms or self-report or whatever. So you can get a jump start on using those large data sets, like I'll never be able to remember now, the MEPS. The Medical Expenditure Panel Study, or the, give me one, Jane. Jane designed this. The SIP, the Survey on Income and Program Participation. But if you were a person, a student, who, you know, was tired of hearing that you can't get published because you're not using the right kind of data, here's an answer to that. I want to close by talking about some future directions for psychiatric rehabilitation research and training. And unfortunately, they kind of mirror the ones I put up there for imperatives for our current center. We have to maximize the capacity of the behavioral workforce. We don't have enough behavioral health providers. We don't have enough of them in the right areas. We firmly believe that one of the ways to make that happen is by integrating peer services and peer supports. Peers want to deliver those services. They're Medicaid reimbursable. We're past the, you know, peers fighting with non-peers in service delivery. I don't know if everybody would say that, but it's really time now to keep pushing and exploring that area. Translating innovative practices, again, to frontline people, not just to the head of a state or the head of an agency that hears about it and says, boy, we sure need that at my agency, and bam, that's it. We want to make those practices available so that they can bubble up from somebody that goes to the solution suite and says, can we lead a wellness group? And the person says, well, I don't know. The state requires that we have manuals and evaluation research. And this person could say, but there are manuals. And there is evaluation research that covers it. We need to specifically develop national and state capacity. If we want systems to change, we need to reach those people who create systems and set the policy that within those that those systems have to operate within. And then knowledge creation and translation, obviously very, very important. We have to keep ensuring that care is informed by knowledge of science and medicine. And that includes occasionally saying, you know, that the emperor has no clothes, that some of the practices that we spend lots of money on have absolutely no evidence base. We have to generate the kinds of outcomes that people in recovery care about, that their families care about, in addition to what managed care wants to pay for or what Medicaid wants to pay for. We have to develop the kind of approaches that improve not just treatment, but people's lives. That's really what I'm after. And we need to forge partnerships across organizational boundaries, like the partnership between NIDLR and SAMHSA, like the partnership between different disciplines that work together in creating a diabetes toolkit, and partnerships that are international so that we can export some of what we've learned to other countries. Here's what we look like on our better days, and just wanted to acknowledge everyone's hard work in making everything I've talked about happen. Here's a very, very small literature citation that no one can see in the room, but if you got the slides, you can get out your magnifying glass and look up any of the literature. And there's my contact information. So thank you for your time and attention today.